Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hello everyone, I am not Helen Garner, and you're disappointed, Sarah's disappointed, but no one is more disappointed than me. So let's come together and harness this collective disappointment and do some good with it in the next 50 minutes. We are meeting on the unceded lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is a privilege, a deep and disquieting privilege to be here on this land, engaging in a conversation about writing and beliefs. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land, and may this acknowledgement never get diluted or co-opted. May it stick in our throats every time we say it. It's sticking in my throat now. And let's talk.
Let's
talk.
Also, sorry, just very quickly, in no way, we know if Helen could be here, she would be, and that's sad for all of us, but Helen and Maria occupy adjacent seating in my personal and literary pantheon, so I'm utterly delighted that you could be here today, so thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Helen gets two seats. And I should also say that Sarah and I spoke recently in Melbourne, so we may have, I mean, we're just very relaxed. Yeah. We're just like...
We'll try to be less relaxed.
It's like 700 people are not here. So, you know, we will try. I'm trying to sit on the edge of my seat and kind of get myself into a more formal
space. I'm activating.
Activating the core, but very relaxed here. So I just wanted to start actually with Helen Garner, in some sense, by asking you how books come into your life and how books come into your mind. Bearing in mind, you only wrote two books, so you know, let's not you know, get carried away here. But
my own books.
Yeah.
I thought you meant more interesting question of other people's.
No. So the reason why I'm thinking about Helen, and I am thinking about her a lot, but she said something quite unforgettable to someone other than me in some other context. But she said that the first line of a book comes to her as music from some other place.
Oh, God.
So it's not kind of, it's not grinded out, it's not extracted from a kind of a, you know, a current project that she's, you know, in the middle of. It kind of comes from another world. So,
and it starts at the beginning. It's so meticulous.
So great.
Mine is not anything like that.
Okay, tell us how yours are not anything like that.
So, I think, both times now, it started with this kind of wet dread of realizing that the material that I had accumulated, like a squirrel with your nuts for the winter, had the arc, or had the potential to have the arc of a book, in its kind of like in the meaning department, not the quantity department, because quantity alone does not make an interesting book. And then realizing that that's going to happen, or I'm going to have to do that now. More other writers sometimes, they have like this joy of coming to the desk and every day is a wonderful adventure. That's not ever been my
experience.
They're
not our friends.
No.
Those writers.
Wet dread. With you, like, do you hear a magical first line?
And this is what Sarah does. Just notice, if you're here to glimpse the character of Sarah, this moment of redirection is very telling, but I'm just gonna ignore. We're here to talk about you and your books, but
I'll get it. Can I just ask you?
You talk about the material squirreling away. English is not my first language, so but the material. So you go around the world. Not in COVID times, but go around sort of whatever spaces you inhabit. Kind of squirreling material without a particular project or a particular idea you are kind of just sort of noticing things and putting them away and aside, and then at some point you know what they're for, or sometimes they're not for anything much.
Yes. So that was definitely what happened with The Believer. It started off by stumbling across the Mennonites, and I don't think very cleanly in the sense of, oh, that would make a great X article or book or whatever. I'm gonna write about that now. It was more like, what the hell's happening here? Who are these people? I need to know. And the real sense of like genuine curiosity, in the sense of compulsive curiosity. I just need to know more for my own sake. And then getting as deep as I can with that story, which then led on to the next one. So yeah, it's kind of a holding the material close until it kind of tells you what it is. With the Trauma Cleaner, that was a similar fortuitousness of stumbling upon Sandra at the legal conference. And then, again, that kind of wonder and awe, what's this person, what's their story, what's happening here? And then on that first kind of discussion, seeing quite clearly the arc of the story, and then the wet dread of, okay, well, what could...
When you say an arc, and you talked about it in relation to a book as well, what do you mean by that? Because I know you, so it's not the cheesy whatever is in the, what's your character arc? Right? It's not that. Like, what is it? It's some kind of, bigness of it, some kind of, it's going somewhere unpredictable. It's non-static, it's paradoxical. Like, what is that kind of epicness of a human being or a subject matter what is it? What is it?
I think the only answer I have is that it's, I'm filled with the wonder of that in a way that will make me call people or tell people in my actual life, this is what I found today. Can listen to this. And I'll just want to tell them. And you're telling them a story, I guess, about what you found and what you think it means or what was there. And it's something more than... I think when I say arc, I mean that it is a story, that it has more than it first appeared on the surface.
Can we stay with that compulsive curiosity and this desire to tell others and the way it's alive in you and the way you you need to stay with it, you cannot walk away from it. So I have done some research since we last spoke, Sarah, and it seems like a lot of people, including my mother, a lot of people in my life are reading your book or have read your book. And they asked me to ask you, and I am sort of taking some liberties with, creating a kind of a composite question here. But so there are, and I've asked a version of this question, I've asked a question before, but now I have the backing of the masses,
okay,
right?
Okay.
So there are incredibly compelling people in that book, you know where it's going, right? And there are some people who do not feel compelling in the same way and do not inspire the same kind of desire to, I want to spend every minute with this person. And have you felt that level of kind of furious interest in another human being or in another world in relation to everyone who's in your book? In other words, how did you make, there are six stories in your book. This is, Helen would never ask a question that would have taken 3 minutes to get to something that,
This question.
So this is, but how did you make choices about the kind of six anchoring stories in this book?
Well, if I'm to say that I'm curious about them, doesn't mean that I feel a great level of comfort with them. Doesn't mean they're making me feel happy or doesn't necessarily, I hesitate to say it doesn't mean I like them because it's not really about liking or not. It's about being interested or being struck by something. And so everyone in that book was someone that I genuinely wanted to know more about. The other thing is that if I'm not interested, I can't fake it. And I had the problem very early on trying to get jobs after uni. My transcript, my uni transcript is appalling because it shows that if I really liked the subject, I'd do very well. And if I didn't like it, I'd fail or barely pass. And so it's kind of like that with like who you're writing about. So it's like if I'm not interested enough to sustain the attention, it's not going to happen. So that doesn't mean I like the person or, you know, I have great respect for the things that they're saying or, you know, I'm not trying to see myself in the person. I'm trying to just see as many views of the world as possible. So everyone there is deliberately in there for that reason.
And you talk about kind of being struck by these people, right? Mm. The, you know, the question of beliefs. Mm. Was it at the start of this project, did you know that ultimately what you wanted, the kinds of questions that you wanted to get closer to or you wanted to be able to ask with kind of greater clarity or conviction, that these questions were about what we believe, what is at stake when we believe in something, why we believe. Was that a kind of the animating energy behind this project?
Yes, not at all, no.
Okay, great. I like yes, no, yes, no at all.
Yes, yeah. No,
yep.
By the Australian yen.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, yep.
I think last time we spoke about this, when I described it as all of these stories that I was kind of immersing myself in made the same sound to me. So there was in the interviews and the conversations and some of the relationships in the book spanned, you know, 2 or 3 years and some like the Creation Museum that was just a week, very, very long week. but in the content of the conversation and you know, they were all making the same sound. They were evoking the same feeling, and it was just a feeling, and it was not unaccompanied by self-explication. So the process was trying to articulate, first of all, to myself what that commonality was, what those echoes were actually saying. And as I started to kind of collect the third story, so the Mennonites led to the Creation Museum, and the Creation Museum led to the Death Doula, and the Death Doula led to the ghosts and the UFO researchers. And the Death Doula also reminded me of the work I was doing with Lynn. So I had some simultaneity?
Don't look to me for English language, you know, or help with that.
She's only won the largest literary award in the world. Anyway, so doing that work at the same time.
Yeah. See? It's easy. Just use human language.
Simple.
Sarah.
Keep it direct.
Yeah.
What was a good way? So I again, still didn't know for a long time what I was going to do with them. I knew I didn't want to sell them off as magazine pieces. I knew I didn't want to write a book of essays. I wanted to build a house of unlike things, and I wanted to do that by telling effectively a seventh story, which was my own interest in whatever this note was that they were hitting. And so that was about, you know, I guess you could call it belief, but it was also like, well, how do we make ourselves well with, what stories do we tell around our interior vulnerabilities? And so it was longing, it was grief, it was the distance between, you know, what we want and what we get, and our willingness to believe in this story to make it better. So it's a long way of answering the question, and I think, like, if you set out, I don't know yet, I've only done the two books, but I think if you set out with a thesis, and at the end of a four-year process, you can neatly answer the question that you asked yourself when you knew nothing, something has gone very wrong.
Yeah. You said something kind of beautiful, many beautiful things. One beautiful thing I want to pull out, a house of unlike things. Can you talk about that? Because I think there's a lot of that unlikeness. Mm-hmm. And if we think about a kind of thematically organized book, here's a book of narrative nonfiction about a theme, X, right? Yeah. And then you kind of imagine this as, you know, there is that theme at the center, and then everything is straining to speak to that center, mm-hmm. and then there is some kind of relationship between the different components. But there is something else going on in your book, intellectually, in terms of the structure, you know, in all kinds of, in terms of where you position yourself. how you think about things that are unlike under the same roof, that roof afforded by a book? Like, what's going on for you?
So I think I mentioned this last time, Theodor Adorno, German philosopher, no one probably cares about him except for me and Maria, and his quote.
Adorno's great.
And now it looks like I'm in the pocket of Big Adorno, like I try to work him into every viral marketing for debt. Anyway.
He's better than most.
He really is.
Yeah.
And I'm going to butcher the quote, because I only see it every day. I have no idea why. But it is that the harmony in art is not achieved by speciously or spuriously like forcing the components into resolution, but making space for dissonance or disharmony. So, I think that that's a beautiful metaphor for what it should look like in our civil society, what our relationships with others and ourself will look like. I think it was what I was hearing with the death doula, Annie, from her 40 years of Tibetan Buddhist reading and practice, and what Lynn was demonstrating in her life of, spending 35 years in prison, which was, the problem isn't the things that we believe or even our willingness to believe something that might not be true. The problem is our stories are too small and not spacious enough to account for everything. So the formal or technical question that I was interested in challenging myself with was, could I come up with a structure that demonstrated what I was hoping to investigate philosophically? Could I have a structure that was a house, a home, for all of these different things to reside together and be knitted together by their commonalities, but still have room for their differences?
And that's really beautiful and profound. Profound. But also, for me, in just thinking about Australian nonfiction, I've been for a while interested, just like you, in pushing against the sameness of the kind of formal units. So all chapters, are kind of roughly the same lengths, or the kind of the relationship between, research and the personal material and, conversations with other people is kind of, sort of staged in roughly the same way. And kind of wanting books, thank you for doing this book in this way that seems kind of paradoxical and just kind of wonderfully so, and beautifully perverse as well. I think I've used the word beautiful way too many times, but no more beautiful. Okay. But, this idea that books are actually places in which very different things can coexist in a way that they cannot coexist in other ways, right? And we need to get in there and stop kind of flattening everything and making, chapters and the sensibilities that kind of populate different parts of the book all, feel and look and sound the same. Let's introduce this idea of, and the practice of difference, dissonance, and unlike things. Yeah. So it's like a house that's got like a shed in the middle and a garage and a cave and not Plato's cave. Another good philosopher, Adorno and Plato. But sorry, just digressing. So you mentioned that you wanted you to come up in the book as the seventh note, not through you taking up the space and writing about yourself and, the role of beliefs or the questioning around beliefs that has kind of structured your life, but by the kind of very interesting coexistence of these six other stories and the way that you appear and disappear through those stories. Can you talk about where you placed yourself in the book and this idea of the seventh note?
Yeah. So, and then I want to say two things, what you just said before. I'll try to remember them.
Do you want a pen?
I'll just do it. No. Sorry. Okay. So, I think that first person perspective is something that either readers like or they don't like, and I don't think you can think about that too much. I only have one voice, and that's how I write. There's no kind of winning. I hear, oh, it's so narcissistic to make the story about you. And then I hear, oh, you weren't in there enough. And, you know, and I've said it before, like in terms of narcissism, as if there's, and you know, the most narcissistic thing is writing from the all-seeing eye of God, impartial, passive third person. Because all nonfiction is selective and partial and subjective, and I feel like the books that I am most drawn to, have the most affinity with, and have hit me the hardest, have been ones that lay that out on the table. This is who I am as the author, is what they say. You know, this is my experience, some of the filter through which I'm running the information, take it or leave it. So those are the books I, you know, love reading, and you know, the decision about how much of myself to put in is kind of guided by a lot of things. You know, is it relevant? Is it, I feel sometimes it's an ethical issue of if I've asked somebody to speak to their interest in something or their vulnerability about something, our conversations naturally go in a way that something like, you know, well, I have no experience of what it's like to see a UFO or have a ghost jump on me physically and wrap their legs around me, but I have felt a similar sense of wonder, or I have felt a similar sense of fear. And so putting that in the book itself, I feel like has a ethical energy that reflects the conversation. Sometimes it solves a structural problem where you can't get from A to B, and so you put yourself in there wondering about how to get from A to B. But generally, I just think it's more interesting to know a little bit about the person writing the book. So that,
well, if anything, what most readers, now I'm not only speaking for people I talk to, but for everyone, but what most people, most readers would say, that there is not enough of you. Oh. So it's not a question of your presence, it's a question, why not more Sarah?
Oh, right. Well, I'm never comfortable putting it in, that's the other thing. Like, the first time I realized it would have to go in, it made sense to go in. For all of those reasons, was in the trauma cleaner, and I thought, oh shit, that's so exposing, I really don't want to do that. And then you do it because it's the truest way that you can write the book.
But you don't do a lot of it. I mean,
no, it feels like a lot to me. Though.
Yeah,
it
no,
feels
it's, I, but it's not.
Oh, right.
Yeah, this, you know, and like people I've talked to, they said, why, we want it more.
See, well, this is, I've made the mistake of reading Maria's work on memoir versus confession. I don't want to get the balance wrong, to have too much of myself. It's always trying to pare back. There's so much that didn't make it in. I mean, the original draft of this book was 200,000 pages. Not pages, Jesus. 200,000 words.
200,000. How many words
even
would that be?
Even I. Yeah, so, and much of that material was personal stuff. So I'm sure we'll use it again. It'll crop up somewhere else. But yeah, I mean, I don't have much interest in writing like heavily memoir-based or having more of it. I get lost in the detail. I think like you can't see out of your own life that clearly. I'd rather, you know, do it in relation to some another story and use that as the bounds of relevance rather than just try to tell my own story in great slabs, but maybe that'll change.
I'm gonna jump around.
Okay, and then I still haven't forgotten my notes, by the
okay,
way.
I'll
be asked a question at some point.
I'm actually going to write drafting here because okay. I want to come back to 200,000 pages / words. But you said something else that I'm likely to forget, so I'll go to that okay. First. Starting those relationships with people you end up writing about by saying, I don't know, I do not see what you see, I do not know what you know, our worlds are very, very different, yeah. But the way I can connect with you is along the axis of fear or wonder, whatever. And you say somewhere in the book, I do research for a living, you don't say, I do writing for a living.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a relationship with research that you have that's kind of very deep and formative. How do you form relationships with people? And I imagine that the one very long week you spent in the Creation Museum would take a very different shape to your relationship with Annie or Lynn. But nonetheless, you know, for people to actually feel that you're not there to extract their juicy stories of, you know, redemption and whatever against all odds, right? Like, for them, to understand, you know, when it comes to some of the sections of the book, when you talk about UFOs or, you know, house clearing or whatever, for them to know that you're not there to ridicule them yeah. or to sort of, you know, belittle and demean them in any way in your prose. What does it take and how do you enter those relationships? Are there relationships where people tell you to go away and never come back? can't imagine that. But, you know, so can you talk about that? Because, and, you know, I know that it took you 4 years to write your first book. It took you 4 years to write this one, which is 4 years is nothing, just by the by. But nonetheless, across the span of 4 years, yeah. it's actually possible to form friendships, to yes. form attachments, to for people to see you for who you are and for you to come closer to seeing them. Yeah. Can you just talk, or you can just go to a couple of people in the book yeah. and tell us about how the relationships that are outside of this book but make this book possible?
So, and I'm interested to know how you did it.
Yeah. We'll take it to a hotel room.
First thing is there's, you know, a lot of stories I had tried to do, some that I had started that didn't end up in the book because I wasn't going to get the level of access that, you know, makes it book worthy, as opposed to something shorter like a profile or a shorter essay. I don't write about anyone that's not immediately into it. I'm not going to be convincing anyone to talk to me. It's just not in my nature. I'm not slick enough. And I've got no interest in writing about anyone for that period of time just to mock them. I mean, unless they're a really dangerous person, but I haven't had that, you know, where humor would serve that purpose. I haven't had that experience yet, and it wasn't, you know, in either of the books, well, what I wanted to use the time for. So it's got to work on both sides. I've got to be interested and, you know, think that the story is worth, that person has a story that, you know, I would benefit from learning from. And to find them, I've already done a huge amount of research. And so I've chosen to ask them to participate for a number of reasons. And maybe it's because I come having done that homework that they agree to participate. I've been knocked back a few times, but not many so far. And maybe it has something to do with, you know, learning about that person's world enough to know that, you know, if they said yes, it'll be worth investing in. So put in a bit of legwork before that point. And then in terms of how the relationships develop, it's really just so personal and kind of on a case-by-case basis, depending, you know, their availability, their, like, you know, physical availability in terms of how much time they have, and then their emotional availability, how deep they want to go. I want, if I've, you know, kind of invested enough in asking that person, I want to know everything about them. You know, I love those, like, shitty magazine columns where it's like, what's in your handbag? I'm like, yes, I want to know literally what is in everybody's bag here today. What they had for lunch. I love asking people, like, what do you do for lunch? Like, you know. So if you're... It's not mercenary. I'm genuinely interested, and I'm asking them a lot of questions. And if they'll give me the time, I'd like to, you know, extend that over time, because in my ideal book-length work, the duration is a dimension of the story. So I want change over time, and I'd like to for them to be sharing things with me that make the material richer and thicker. But, you know, at the end of the day, I don't consider myself a journo, but I do factual writing. So it is not a friendship in the sense that I'm going to err on that kind of likability factor. At the end of the day, I have to err on the side of factual writing because my contract is with the reader. to deliver what it says on the book, which is nonfiction. So sometimes, you know, Janet Malcolm writes about this extensively. You know, you're going to have those dilemmas. But you know, my book's out, my notebook's out, my recorder's on, and you know, I look and act completely out of place, I'm sure. And so there's always that kind of aspect of the interaction. But it differs. It differs according to the person. I guess that's the short answer.
Can I just, so many things to ask. One thing, when you say that ultimately your contract is with the reader, that when you think about the kind of the ethical framework within which you operate, there is a primacy that is given to the reader and not deceiving the reader. There is... you know, there are other kind of ethical responsibilities, right? That as writers of nonfiction, as factual writers, we're living under or in the shadow of or in a kind of intense relationship to. One is, of course, the relationship or our ethical obligations to people that we are writing about, and the other one is to the subject matter itself, right? And you've heard me say that, but I will say it again, that I think one of your great superpowers as a writer is your ability to let us know that the person in front of us is an unreliable narrator of their own world and their own history, but to do it in such a way as not to undercut them, undermine them, as not to wink at the reader and say, you know, this person, you know, I'm going to reproduce this person's kind of self-narrativization, but actually this person is kind of not to be trusted, right?
Yeah.
How do you do that? because this is a way of actually being honoring your responsibility to the people you write about and to the readers at the same time, and not thinking of them as sometimes in opposition to each other. And I think a lot of writers of nonfiction struggle with that, like, who do I address myself to and who do I owe the most to? Yes. But it feels to me in the way that you write that you don't see that as a choice and you're able to do both.
Thank you. That's very fortifying. I think that the answer is something to do with context. Because, and also something to do with, I want to say like something, okay, I don't even know what the second part is. The first part, I'll get to it though, I'll remember. The first part, if you kind of unpack the context in which the person that you're talking to who's saying that unreliable thing was acting in, or coming from, or formed by, that does a lot of the work of judgment. So that you are honoring their truth that they're sharing with you, and you're honoring truth insofar as it relates to factual writing, and your capacity for discernment, that little thing inside you that says, this is horse shit. Because if you ignore that, again, you're disappointing your ethical obligations for the reader and probably yourself. So there's space for all of that. And if you do it with enough context, I think you can respect everyone's humanity and the ethical obligations. The second thing I was thinking of was... I was reading on the plane on the way over here this will make me sound very current, my New York Review of Books from last year, which is as up to date as I get. And it was an article by Valeria Luiselli, on Dorothea Lange exhibition. So American documentary photographer, 1930s Depression, Dust Bowl migration. And she was saying that Lange had over her, in her dark rooms, always carried this quote from Francis Bacon, the 16th century philosopher, not the 20th century painter, although I think it's spelled the same. Anyway, and it was something, again, which I'll butcher, but it had to do with capturing things as they are, is more noble than any, imposture, I think he put it, that can be done to them. And it's interesting when you think of her work and that frankness, and I guess the difference between a documentary photographer like Dorothea Lange and one like Diane Arbus, whose work I also enjoy looking at. But I think there's a kind of a different dignity. And I think, so this is a long way of saying, I think if you're, I like reading a certain kind of nonfiction and looking at certain documentary visual art that has to do with bearing witness. And so if your question is less about what, you know, let me show you how clever I am by judging this person before me, and more like, these are all the possible worldviews of the same world, I think that second one is much more interesting. So I now forgot what the question was.
But you've answered it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and you, by answering it, you made it redundant.
Thank you.
Only your answer will survive. The question is gone.
It's Sontag. The only interesting answers are the ones that destroy the question.
Yeah,
it makes
you've done that.
Adversarial now.
Well, talking about adversarial, okay, let's go there, because you've used the word adversarial. I'm just completely at your mercy.
All right.
I just throw words and, like, you know. So, Sarah, you are also a lawyer.
Yes, sorry.
And some people, yes, fair enough. Some people who are more connected to the world of law than I am tell me that they can tell that you are a lawyer. That there is something about your relationship with evidence, your relationship with what it is that you are doing on the page that tells them that this is part of who you are, in a way that I cannot see because I'm not of that world and from that world.
That's probably why you like me.
Yes,
don't
possibly.
Don't look for it.
Do you feel torn by these two things that you are in any way, or have you found a way to be both in your writing in a way that is not tense and adversarial and a kind of a, conflicted?
That's a great question, thank you.
So the other ones were not so good.
No. This is the best. We fixed the best. No, I feel like it's given me some great things at training. I wasn't a particularly great lawyer. Like, I feel like I was there for the stories. You get access to a lot of cases, and they are all about context and causation and character and evidence and all the things I love in factual writing, and they're all just kind of endless permutations of the same human dramas. My area is criminal law, sentencing specifically. So when it comes to kind of evidence and that research aspect, that was good. I feel like the training also, well, it was my only writing training, so speak directly, boldly, like that, kind of try to just be as frank as you can on the page. But no, other than that, it doesn't really serve the creative impulse because, you know, a certain personality drawn to law for that long and that intensely is, you know, going to, it's something's not working, so you're going to do it harder and you're going to sit there longer. And that's not how the books that I'm interested in writing and reading work. You have to kind of pull back. You have to listen to what the material is saying. You can't impose a structure on it. You can't impose a meaning on it. To a degree, you have to just listen to what the process is telling you. Very uncomfortable for a certain personality to pull back and let the unconscious kind of knit things together. And particularly with sentencing, you know, that judging impulse that there'll be a resolution. Emily Nussbaum, who I like very much, writes for The New Yorker, wrote about TV for a long time, and she, again, I'm going to butcher this, but it was something about...
I think she stopped writing. I think you're so out of date, you don't even... Can anyone verify that? I haven't seen her byline...
I don't think she writes about TV anymore. I think she was, now writing more... I'm not...
Okay. Anyway, okay.
This was...
Sorry, I was just trying to contradict you.
I'm definitely not, please. Yeah. I mean, she probably... I think she's still around.
Yeah.
Maybe. Anyway, so it was about fiction... resolution being something for fiction and for fiction only, and you don't get that control in nonfiction. But, you know, you do get that control in law. It's a very artificial environment, so you will, you know, have a clear answer. There can only be one answer. Very unsatisfying when you're writing creatively, because if you're doing it right, you won't have one answer, or shouldn't.
Let's go back to the, and I'm just looking at the time, because I'm
asking. Oh, right, yes.
Yeah. 200,000 words. How many words is the book?
It's just under 100,000 now.
Okay, so half is gone. What is gone?
So
what is it that we're not reading? And can we get hold of it?
A lot of it was like various permutations of the personal bits. Which, yeah, like I said, will probably appear later in later work, maybe, if I'm lucky enough. And yeah, just larger portions of each of the stories, because, you know, it's 4 years for most of them, ongoing conversations and other scenes and, you know, more background, my impulses, you know, to provide as much detail as possible. And that's the other thing, I mean, that distinguishes it from something more forensic or legal, is that you've got, you know, the CCTV camera footage of life, and these are the facts, and here's the transcript, and this is what I was thinking, and this is what we were doing. And then you have the story, which is, well, what does it all mean? Why were you there? What's the point of it? What do you see here? And so that endless process of selection means that most of it's going to go if you're doing it properly. I find that very difficult, though.
What's your relationship to detail? And how do you see, is the story the kind of accumulation of those details of what's in the bag?
Yeah, I only really see detail.
Okay.
I find it really difficult until very late in the process to make any kind of monolithic assertions. Like, in my worst nightmare, if somebody would be like, so what do you think about the state of feminism today? And I'd just be like, I had
that was my...
I'll come up with something.
Yeah.
My eye just goes towards details and the kind of a pointillist, that's what I'm interested in, and they're always going to be conflicting. And so you're like, oh shit, how can anything be said about anything? It's a great place to be for a writer. It's also a terrifying place to be as a person. But I feel that's where I live most of the time.
No pressure, but this is a great way to... Yeah. To start a question, right? Are you a different person in any way at the end of this book? Not changed by your great exploration of belief systems?
I've been redeemed.
No. But are you changed by working on a project of this magnitude in some molecular, subcellular level? Are you looking for that kind of to be undone by the work or to be reconstituted by the work that you do? Are you looking for that kind of relationship between your writing and your soul and your being?
I wish I was. Like, that sounds like I'd be such a better person.
It's not late. It's time.
I feel like I learned a lot from Annie and from Lynn. I feel like certain things that terrified the bejesus out of me at the beginning only terrify me a little less now. So having that proximity to the sort of kind of the bravery of those two women and getting to know them, Katrina as well, before she died, I feel like that was a really hard part of the book to write. I put it off for a very long time, and then it gave me a lot of... It made me moderately less scared of things like death and sickness and injustice and all of those things. And Annie would say even a little bit less is huge progress.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I think if you're doing it right, you probably end up with more questions than you started with. Mm. So it's not a great... I mean, it's not like working in a coal mine, but it's like... It's a place that doubts... reigns supreme. So no, I've not been.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't mean that you now see the light, or you know. I just meant that, you know, and in a kind of less redemptive, categorical sense, whether you're looking to always write a book that you could not have written before, if that makes sense.
I feel like I set myself, you know, this goal of trying to do this, and, you know, I'm never like, yes, I did a great job. It's always like the work and what you had hoped, and those two things never match up for me. But I feel like this is the best I could have done. So,
It always needs to feel a bit impossible or a lot impossible.
Yes. Yeah. God forbid I would feel satisfied with anything.
I need to get hold of this iPad. I need to...
Just checking her emails.
Yeah, that's fine. I need to... Okay, so there is a question that has been asked by a questioner in Tasmania. What is the most memorable set of beliefs you researched that didn't make it into the book?
Oh, wow. Jeez. Well, I think everything... I'm trying to think what I cut that didn't make it into the book. I don't think I can answer that. I apologize. I think the most memorable stuff made it in. I'm just trying to think what I cut that would have been interesting.
Don't worry. That's fine. Sorry, questioner from Tasmania.
Oh, well, this is an interesting thing. There was the Mennonites, for people, I'm sure many people haven't read it. They're like Amish people and religious fundamentalists. They don't use technology. But there was close connections between the Mennonites that I was interviewing and the Amish community in Pennsylvania where they were from. They were showing, one of the women was showing me their photo album, and they had gone on their corporate retreat the year before to the Creation Museum, which is how I found out about it. And they had an internet filtering business. And so they went with all their computer programmers. And there was an Amish young man there, very young man. And he stuck out a little bit because they're just slightly different. They're much more restricted in what they allow, and they don't even use zippers. It's all buttons and there's no technology. So it's quite a closed community. And I said, oh, is he part of the Mennonite community? And she said, oh no, he's Amish and he's blind. And he's a computer programmer. And he was called to do that work and he had to receive a special dispensation from the elders. And they have allowed him to use computers and to pursue coding. And I never got to speak to that guy, but if anyone's out there, I can find him. That was, I thought, a wonderful, you know, it seems so dissonant, but there's something very intriguing and strange and beautiful about that story, and that didn't make it in. Mm. So, the Amish programmer.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for answering. And, okay. We have 1 minute left. What do you think we could do?
Well, I could get to my answer.
Okay.
Now it's dangling out there. I can't weave it back in. But you said about the kinds of nonfiction that don't follow formula, don't follow kind of the way it should look in terms of chapters. And Maria's essay on wildness and how one sentence or one idea shouldn't necessarily tell the reader what's going to come next. I think that has inspired me so greatly, because when you think, oh shit, what am I doing? It's so strange. No one else is going to get it. And you think, well, maybe that's where we should all be putting ourselves more frequently as readers and as writers. Because if it makes sense to you and it's surprising and it opens up new pathways, I think it's a really worthwhile thing to do. And I got that from you and from your writing. So thank you.
Well, this moment in which Sarah praises me is a completely inappropriate moment in which to finish this session. We are done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.